Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Trish reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. Education. NAACP, any name with Lee is offensive. By Stuart Doreen. sdoreen@mrt.com. The head of the local NAACP unit has sent an email to the Midland ISD board that states any future name of Robert E. Lee High School that keeps part of the original name is offensive. The letter was sent to the board Sunday night and follows the meeting of the renaming committee last week. During that meeting, members of the committee voted to make Legacy of Equality and Excellence their number one recommendation for the new name of the senior and the freshman schools. The name is similar to a school in San Antonio that also shortens the name to L-E-E. Any future name that resembles or keeps part of the name of Confederate general and the first general to surrender during the Civil War, Robert E. Lee, is offensive, as it allows the original name to continue to be associated with the original intent of the name, said Eddie Rabb, R-A-B-B, president of the Midland NAACP unit number 6354. Rabb wrote that the NAACP objects to the board's decision to populate the committee with those against the name change, as they inevitably would try to keep some aspect of the original name. He also objected to alleged secret meetings with certain committee members to determine a strategy for keeping the name. Rabb also called the use of members of the African American community on the committee as an attempt to placate. Rabb said their presence could later allow others to state the process was fair and justified. The final three recommendations from the committee are L.E.E. High School, Midland Tall City High School, and Midland Carverly High School. Rabb wrote the naming of the schools L.E.E. or Midland Carverly will lead the community, will lead to the community continuing to refer to the name of the school as Lee. Consider the Ku Klux Klan, referred to as the KKK. If this organization changes its name to the Kind Kids Campaign and still be referred to as the KKK, the connotation would still cause people to associate it with the Ku Klux Klan and affiliate the new organization with the old. It will be an insult to the local African American community who have tried to get rid of this name since its inception, for the name change to not reflect the spirit of the vote to disassociate the name with Confederate general and first general to surrender during the Civil War, Robert E. Lee. Rabb ended his letter stating, "This process will show the world that Southern backroom politics are still alive in Midland, and that this process will also be an embarrassment for the citizens of Midland. While other communities all over the country are getting rid of the stigma of association with traitors to the United States of America, that Midlanders are trying to find ways to keep the association and that it lacks of sensitivity and rebukes decency." The following is the letter from Eddie Rabb, president of the Midland NAACP unit. The NAACP unit 6254 has established these positions on the local name change of the high school and junior high school. While we understand that we have always been in the minority on this issue and that the renaming committee was designed to not produce viable alternatives to the name that needed to be removed, we nevertheless state the following. Any future name that resembles or keeps part of the name of Confederate general and first general to surrender during the Civil War, Robert E. Lee, is offensive, as it allows the original name to continue to be associated with the original intent of the name. We object to populating the committee that recommends the name change with those who were against the name change, as they inevitably would try to keep some aspect of the original name. We object to the secret meetings with certain committee members to determine strategy for keeping the name at the private home of a supporter for keeping the name. We object to the placatory members of the African American community who were selected because of their sympathy with the original name, and also to later be used by those who used those actions to state that the process was fair and justified. Naming the schools L-E-E or Midland Carverly will lead to the community continuing to refer to the school as Lee. Consider the Ku Klux Klan, referred to as the KKK. If this organization changes its name to Kind Kids Campaign and still is referred to as the KKK, the connotation would still cause citizens to associate it with the Ku Klux Klan and affiliate the new organization to the old. It will be an insult to the local African-American community who have tried to get rid of this name since its inception for the name change to not reflect the spirit of the vote to disassociate the name with the Confederate general and first general to surrender during the Civil War, Robert E. Lee. This process will show the world that Southern backroom politics are still alive in Midland, Texas. This process will also be an embarrassment for the citizens of Midland that while other communities all over the country are getting rid of the stigma of association with traitors to the United States of America, Midlanders are actively trying to find ways to keep the association and that it lacks of sensitivity and rebukes decency. Eddie V. Rabb, President, Midland NAACP Unit 6354. Commentary. NYSD's interim leader is known for quickly identifying problems, by Stuart Doreen. There are people who will doubt what an interim superintendent can do in a short period of time. Anyone who read the Facebook comments about the story on Midland ISD's interim chief, Ann Dixon, has seen that. How much can she impact culture and straighten out a district in which the problems go back more than a decade? Even the straight shooting comments from Dixon herself couldn't eliminate all the doubters. Maybe that's where John Anderson comes in. Anderson is Red Oak ISD board president. For those interested, Red Oak is a district located south of Dallas that serves more than 6,000 students. First comments about Dixon were from Anderson. She is the epitome that dynamite comes in small packages and that she makes up in stature with her work ethic. Driving by the district building at 9 p.m. and seeing her light on is not out of the ordinary. She is probably working because she doesn't want to go to a hotel, he told the Reporter Telegram. Anderson said she takes the responsibility of being an interim superintendent seriously. Looking at Dixon's resume, interim work has become her specialty. Her last 21 jobs have been as an interim or consulting superintendent. She works an average of 5 months at a time in a district, but that doesn't mean she acts like a short timer. She knows how to go into a district, identify problems, and most importantly, gives districts a chance to fix the problems, Anderson said. She doesn't leave a stone unturned. This is my 19th year as a school board member, and we learn new things from her. Anderson's comments are likely a boost for Midlanders who have been shell-shocked by recent educational events, ratings, leadership change, COVID-19 changes, and Midland rename and school renaming. Anderson said Midland is lucky to have captured her because had MISD not locked her into an agreement, another district would have. She doesn't sit around and wait for someone to call, he said. Having written that, Midland ISD will be different. Midland ISD is one of the largest districts she has led and certainly a district beaten down by the inability to solve problems. MISD's problems with long-term failing campuses are well documented. The sheer number of failing campuses per capita rival any larger school district in the state. Midland isn't like most other communities in Texas with its separation between the haves and the have-nots, as well as the number of private schools. School choice is practiced in Midland like few other communities around the state, and with that, Midland has been impacted by the amount of support in the community. But Anderson said the challenges feed into what Dixon does best, or, as he said, that is the beauty of her. Dixon wants the challenge that a new district brings, whether it's helping turn around a district struggling financially or working to help get a bond passed. Both are part of her past, she said. She wants to get everyone calm and going down the right path, Anderson said. And Dixon wasn't shy about talking about accountability. She said her contract is one that either side can break with 2 weeks' notice. If she isn't performing, the district can go in another direction and vice versa. She also talked about accountability for those in the district. Dixon looked at Midland ISD's metrics and was concerned about the lack of results and wants to know why that was the case. I don't like to say schools fail. I know that everything else says that. And I don't like to say kids fail, Dixon told the Reporter Telegram in an article Sunday. We failed. The people making these decisions are the ones who have failed. And so I want to find out who's failing and what changes do there need to be. Now, saying that and saying that to you, because the recorder's probably back on, and then people are going to feel like they've been put on notice. And if that's what it takes, then that's what we're going to do. Midland bars jump through hurdles to reopen. Addition of food vendors, another license having an impact on bars reopening during the pandemic. By J.C. Lewis. J.C. Lewis at HearstNP.com. Midland bars, which have been shut down for about 6 months, have started to reopen with the help of food trucks. But this lifeline does come with a cost. Owners can reopen their business if they receive a food and beverage license, which costs $776, an initial fee of $200, and surcharges of $576 for a two-year period, according to the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission's website. Erica Mann, owner of the Blue Door, has applied for the second license but doesn't understand why the bar industry is unable to operate and is being monitored when no other industry is during this time. In general, the industry is being decimated, she said. I'm seeing people, bar owners in Texas, having to close their bars. I see it two or three times a week, and it's getting worse right now. Mann said she doesn't know how many Midland bar owners have had to close their doors, but she has watched friends across the state making tough calls. She said the supply of the Paycheck Protection Program funds has been exhausted and many owners have spent their savings. Many who applied for loans have been turned down because banks don't want to lend money to small business owners who are unable to operate. Mann said Governor Greg Abbott's inability to give bars a deadline for reopening has been one of the hardest parts. She said his announcement on Thursday was disappointing because other types of businesses were able to open to greater capacity while bars remain closed. Mann said she applied for the food and beverage license in order to reopen the Blue Door. We have never minded having to elevate our game and do things differently in order to be safe. We should be allowed to operate. If he, Abbott, wants to penalize businesses who aren't following the guidelines, I have no issue with that. It's kind of kicking people financially while they're down because the rules for operation for restaurants have not changed. In fact, they've loosened from 50% to 75% capacity. In order to participate in that loosening of restrictions, we have to pay, which is very difficult for some bar owners who haven't had income for 6 months, minus 3 weeks. Bars in Texas were allowed to reopen in June. 3 weeks later, Abbott again shut them down when the number of coronavirus cases spiked. The Blue Door will be able to reopen with the help of Tequila's Mexican restaurant, which is located in the same shopping complex, Mann said. The bar offered food from Tequila's when it reopened in June. Mann said not every bar owner can find a food truck to park at its site, and some locations aren't food truck friendly because of lease regulations. Tall City Brewing Company General Manager Jeff Thomas said his business received a food and beverage license. The bar filed for the license on August 26th and received it on September 10th. The brewery reopened September 11th with food trucks on site during operating hours. We had about 6 to 8 food trucks in rotation before this, so it really hasn't been an issue, he said. Tall City has several new things brewing because of the forced time off. The brewery introduced the peach wheat beer when it reopened and will be setting up for Oktoberfest, Halloween, and its one-year anniversary in November. Thomas said patrons know the protocol and the brewery hasn't had any issues since reopening. We are trying to be open as normal as we can during this time. Patrons were thrilled that we were open and happy to come back to their spot. The Buffalo Nickel General Manager Michael Mielnick said the bar is searching for a food truck that will park outside the downtown business when it reopens. He said being a bar manager is very stressful and confusing during this time. It feels like almost every day something new is coming up or we have a new obstacle to overcome. A lot of it is playing catch up right now. We're trying to do what's best for the bar at this point. He said the coronavirus pandemic and oil taking a downturn has left the bar in a bad position staff-wise. About 5 bartenders left because they moved or found other jobs. I have 2 remaining staff, and basically it's going to have to be a re-grand opening whenever we do open because we're going to have to train staff. With the uncertainty of when we are going to open, it makes it even harder to hire and to train staff. Media. Reporter Telegram rewards subscribers with insider content by Stuart Doreen. For years, our readers have made the Reporter Telegram the most viewed local news website in Midland. No one covers our community and the oil industry better. The Reporter Telegram brings you the best information when it comes to the oil industry, business, local government, healthcare, education, entertainment, philanthropy, and local sports. And that will always be the case. Today, we start a new era for the Reporter Telegram and MRT.com media. It is best explained by saying that we are providing more value for your subscription. We are launching the MRT.com Insider, a status for our content that represents the best of what we are. Local journalism matters, and it is time that those who subscribe to the print edition or those who subscribe to the e-edition receive a greater benefit for that investment in the Reporter-Telegram. So beginning today, some of our best work will be for insiders. You will see that today, with J.C. Lewis's story on Borden County being coronavirus-free, or her story about how bars are struggling because of Governor Greg Abbott's restrictions, the same can be said with Caitlin Randall's story for subscribers only on DWIs in Midland during the pandemic, and her story this week about the pandemic's impact on family. It doesn't mean there won't be contact for everyone at MRT.com. The latest in breaking news and sports will always be there, but our best journalism will be there exclusively for digital and print subscribers. Readers who subscribe will have full access to the e-edition and complete access to all stories on MRT.com. They will receive our subscriber digital newsletter, which provides a behind-the-scenes look into our newsroom. There will be other insider benefits, including insider access to the newsroom, something many of our subscribers have experienced with the launch of the afternoon digital newsletter. Again, for current subscribers, you are already in the club, but for those interested in being more engaged, more involved, and more informed, an insider investment is the way to go. The following Q&A offers more information about today's launch. So, what is happening? We are launching a new benefit for our print and digital subscribers, the Insider. Insider is our staff's best reporting on our community, available only to subscribers. As a subscriber, you will have complete access to this content, both in print and online. And over the coming weeks, you will see the Insider designation on premium stories on the website and need only log in to read the exclusive content. We will be unveiling introductory offers for a digital subscription soon. To non-subscribers who want to stay connected with our reporters and the community. If someone is already a print subscriber, they get access to the digital subscription free of charge. They just need to go to one of our sites to activate it. Why are you charging me money for stuff I've always read for free? It takes time and manpower to deliver award-winning journalism that informs our community and keeps democracy working. We need to pay staffers to make phone calls, dig through documents, sit in meetings, write stories, edit stories, run websites, and more. We need your support to keep uncovering and telling stories that help our community confront its problems, challenges, and opportunities. We also want to hear from you. With your subscription, you'll gain exclusive access to the editors and reporters behind the news, as well as more opportunities than ever before to guide the stories we cover and let us know how we're doing. Why are some stories free while some require a subscription? How do you decide? There is no hard to fast rule as to what makes a story free or not. In general, our insider stories, the ones you have to pay for, offer insight you won't find elsewhere. Did an opinion writer analyze a new law? That goes on the insider. Did a reporter use sources to get an exclusive scoop or write the story that no one thought to write? That's an insider piece too. In short, we decide on a case-by-case basis, but we also believe you deserve to know what's happening in your town as it's happening, especially when it comes to public safety, and that's why we're still devoted to resources and breaking news and keeping it free for you. What does the Insider Digital subscription include? First, you get access to all the best local content produced in the newsroom. You'll also get a behind-the-scenes look into the newsroom and the biggest stories unfolding in our community each day. Subscribers get an exclusive afternoon newsletter with access to our journalist hand-curated sneak peeks, insider-only content, breaking news, and a letter from the editor and more. More than that, you'll get the e-edition, an electronic version of the print edition sent to the inbox each morning. You'll have opportunities to share your voice, connect with journalists, and steer the coverage. How much does it cost? As an introductory offer, digital-only access is just 95 cents for the first month and $9.95 each month after that. Do I have to pay extra if I already subscribe to print? No, all you have to do is activate your digital subscription. You'll automatically be signed up to get an electronic version of the paper in your email inbox every morning, plus a curated email newsletter designed and built for subscribers. Who does a reader contact if they have trouble signing up or accessing their account? You can contact Circulation at 688-2700 or Lisa, L-I-S-A dot Molinar, M-O-L-I-N-A-R at HearstNP.com. Why should I subscribe? You don't cover enough local news in my community. If we aren't covering the right news in your community, being a subscriber gives you the chance to let us know and be a part of the conversation. We're bringing subscribers behind the scenes and detailing the news gathering process and letting our readers help us decide what's important to cover. Why should I subscribe? I can get the news for free from other places. When you become an insider, you get access to coverage that goes beyond what you'll find elsewhere. When news breaks, we will use our extensive network of sources to give you the inside scoop. We don't just cover the press conference or the meeting about the news of the day. We bring you an analysis of how it could impact you. Importantly, your subscription also gives you a behind-the-scenes look at how we do, what we do, and multiple chances to give feedback on what you think we could do better. Finally, your subscription helps support local journalism and the people who tell the story of our town to the world. City reports 37 new coronavirus cases from staff reports. The Midland Health Department on Monday reported 37 new coronavirus cases. This case count for Saturday through Monday is 9 more than the 3-day September 12th through 14th total the city reported a week ago. Monday's new cases bring Midland County's total to 3,588 and are reflective of lab results from Friday and Saturday, according to a press release from the city. The health department also reported there are 763 isolated cases. 2,180 people have recovered, 359 cases are under investigation, and 205 cases are unable to locate or refused. Also, there have been 81 COVID-19 related deaths in Midland County since the pandemic began. Texas begins relaxing some COVID-19 restrictions, Associated Press. Austin. Texas on Monday began relaxing some coronavirus restrictions, including allowing restaurants to let more people inside. Governor Greg Abbott announced the changes last week. Bars, though, still remain closed indefinitely, and a mask mandate is still in place following a massive summer spread that became one of the deadliest outbreaks in the U.S. Under the new orders, restaurants and retail shops that until now have only been allowed to operate at half capacity were allowed to open up to 75% starting Monday in most of the state. The Texas Department of State Health Services on Monday reported 1,742 new coronavirus cases and 24 more deaths due to COVID-19, the illness caused by the virus. Health officials say there have been 698,387 reported cases in Texas so far. The death toll is at 14,917. The true number of cases is likely higher, though, because many people haven't been tested and studies suggest people can be infected and not feel sick. MPD, alleged victim states his car was shot at. From staff reports, the Midland Police Department reported Monday that a person said his vehicle was shot at earlier in the morning on Loop 250. MPD told the Reporter-Telegram in an email that officers were dispatched at 6:26 a.m. to Loop 250 in Garfield in reference to an aggravated assault. The alleged victim stated that someone in a black Chevy lifted pickup shot at his vehicle 3 times. Road rage is believed to be a factor in the aggravated assault, said MPD. MPD also stated that the alleged shooting was an isolated incident and there is no indication of recurring shootings happening on the loop. Anyone with information should call MPD, non-emergency line, 685-7108. From the opinion page for September 22, 2020. Guest view. Ted Cruz accidentally shows Democrats the way forward. On the one hand, to hear Senate Republicans tell it, Democrats are barely this side of evil incarnate. They have hung the American people out to dry, said Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming this month. They stand for radical leftism and hating Trump, claimed Senator Ted Cruz in August. On the other hand, according to Senate Republicans, Democrats are also the model for the latest Supreme Court fight. If the president were Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, and Chuck Schumer were the majority leader, Cruz told ABC's George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, the odds are 100% that Democrats would seek to nominate and confirm a replacement for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg as soon as possible. If the shoe were on the other foot and the Democrats had the White House and the Senate, Barrasso argued on NBC, they would right now be trying to confirm another member of the Supreme Court. And do you know what? They're right. And going forward, Democrats should likewise remember to ask, what would the other side do? Facing a 6-3 conservative majority on the nation's highest court for years to come, Democrats might have mighty obstacles to overcome. How would a Democratic Party that played GOP-style hardball approach them? Some reforms are obvious. Deep Blue District of Columbia, population 700,000, and more politically mixed Puerto Rico, population 3.2 million, should have the same statehood status as Wyoming, 579,000, and Vermont, 624,000. Supreme Court judges should be subject to term limits, so the balance of this crucial institution is not subject to the whims of the Grim Reaper. When it comes to the broader balance of power at the judicial branch, the next Democratic president should brook no delay on nominees to lower courts. Others are less clear-cut. A number of Democrats have come out in support of expanding the number of Supreme Court justices, all but in direct retaliation for President Barack Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. Often left unanswered is the question of what happens when Republicans retake power and inevitably expand the court in their direction. How does the cycle of an ever larger end before reaching absurd levels? This is not to say Democrats should not look to expand the court, especially if they take the White House and the Senate, but Republicans ram through a nominee in the lame duck anyway. It's just that a bigger Supreme Court is not the panacea some think it is. In the meantime, Democrats should crank up the political pressure on the court. As Matt Karp points out at Jacobin, the politicization of the Supreme Court is hardly unprecedented. In the late 1850s and in the early 1860s, even as anti-slavery Republicans gained control of both branches of government, the Supreme Court remained firmly in pro-slavery hands, led by Chief Justice Roger Taney, the author of the infamous Dred Scott decision. So anti-slavery forces unleashed broadsides against the court's authority. The justices said, Senator from Maine and Abraham Lincoln's future vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, had no more authority to decide a political question for us than we had to decide a judicial question for them. Lincoln did add an additional justice, writes Karp, but more fundamentally, Republicans simply ignored the pro-slavery precedents established in the 1850s. In June 1862, for instance, Congress passed and Lincoln signed a bill banning slavery from the federal territories, a direct violation of the majority ruling in Dred Scott. The court meekly acquiesced, recognizing that its political power was long since broken. With the Supreme Court poised to return to its role as a right-wing fortress, with Republicans ever more committed to minoritarian rule, Democrats must leverage the voice of the people. That means legislatively repairing the damage the court has already done, such as by passing a new Voting Rights Act, and make it as politically difficult as possible for reactionary justices to legislate from the bench. However infallible justices style themselves, the Supreme Court has shied away from unpopular decisions in the past. Given that this movement will be in the service of preserving protections for women, minorities, and other historically oppressed groups, it is hard to think anything more American. By James Downey, Washington Post.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, September 22, 2020. Local. City crews continue with water meter replacement. The city of Midland is about two-thirds complete with the installation of new water meters. The AMI, Advanced Metering Infrastructure, smart meters, will help detect leaks faster for both the city and the customers, according to a press release from the city spokeswoman. City crews are working to fill in all areas that do not have AMI smart meters. City crews will knock on customers' doors before replacing the meter. If no one is home and there is no water use showing on the meter, they will move forward with replacement. Once the replacement is complete, they will leave a door hanger to let the customer know the meter was replaced. The installation phase of the water meter project is estimated to be completed within 18 to 24 months from its start in fall 2019. The work to replace meters will be performed during normal working hours of 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. Customers with questions may call customer service at 685-7320. Gas prices in Midland-Odessa. Midland-Odessa gas prices have fallen 3.6 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $1.92 a gallon on Monday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 156 stations. Gas prices in Midland-Odessa are 2.4 cents per gallon lower than a month ago and stand 57.2 cents per gallon lower than a year ago. The following are gasoline prices in Midland, Odessa on September 21, going back 10 years. 2019, $2.49 a gallon. 2018, $2.98 a gallon. 2017, $2.55 a gallon. 2016, $1.93 a gallon. 2015, $2.03 a gallon. 2014, $3.16 a gallon. 2013, $3.28 a gallon. 2012, $3.75 a gallon. 2011, $3.49 a gallon. 2010, $2.65 a gallon. Source, GasBuddy.com. League to help register voters. Members of the League of Women Voters of Midland will be at the Midland County Annex on October 5 to assist residents who want to register to vote or update their registration if they have moved. October 5 is the deadline to register or update registration in Texas for the November 3 election. Residents of Midland County can register in person at the Midland County elections. Mail-in application must be postmarked no later than October 5. Also, the deadline to request a ballot by mail is October 23. Early voting period is October 13 through 30. Go to votetexas.org or vote411.org for more information. Meeting today, City Council, 10 a.m., Council Chambers, City Hall, 300 North Lorraine Street. When it's open, Midland County Tax Assessor Collector, 2110 North A Street, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, 688-4810. Midland Central Appraisal District, 4631 Andrews Highway, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 699-4991. Department of Public Safety Driver's License Office, 2800 Wright Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday and Wednesday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays, 686-1120. City Watering Schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the watering schedule from 2 days a week to 4 days a week. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. The Utilities Department says residents should not overwater the lawn and should watch for puddles or runoff from sprinklers. Today in History. Today is Tuesday, September 22, the 266th day of 2020. There are 100 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On September 22, 1862, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, declaring all slaves in rebel states should be free as of January 1, 1863. On this date, in 1949, the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb.
Obituaries and death notices for Tuesday, September 22nd. Brian Matthew Templeton. Brian Matthew Templeton, 40, graduated from his earthly confines to his heavenly reward on September 17, 2020, in Azle, Texas. He is survived by his parents, Bob and Lois Templeton of Azle, Texas, his brother, Mark David Templeton, and wife, Candace, and their son, Trevor Nathan of Louisville, his grandmother, Eileen Furman of Mesquite, Texas, formerly of Perryton, his uncle, Charles Templeton of Odessa, Texas, his aunt, Allie Templeton of Sugarland, and his uncle, Tom Templeton, and children, Sharon and Keith of Washington State, and his uncle, Mike Furman, and daughter Jennifer Furman of Garland, Texas. The family requests tributes to Brian be directed towards MARC, Inc. of Midland, the Spirit Wind Choir, or any mental health care organization of your choice. White's Funeral Home in Azle, Texas is coordinating arrangements. Christine S. Hubbard, 71, of Midland, passed away September 18, 2020. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 Tuesday, September 22, 2020, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, September 23, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Christine is survived by her sister, Barbara Harris, and husband, Tara, sister Frances Osborne and husband Dave, and sister Patricia Strickland and husband Art, son Carl Hubbard, son Donnie Hubbard and wife Shannon, son Russell Hubbard and wife Crystal, daughter Karen Hubbard, daughter Sybil Carby, and husband David, brother-in-law Johnny Hubbard and wife Deborah, niece Julie Hubbard, Marty Barrett and wife Shannon, niece Debbie Brown, niece Sabrina Fast, and husband Curtis, niece Jackie Maciel, and husband Mario, niece Lori Osborne, nephew Corey Strickland and wife Roxy, Amy Strickland, Jeremy Strickland, and granddaughters Carrie, Casey, Summer, Erica, Katie, Amanda, Jessica, and Kinsey. Grandsons, Jason, William, Patrick, Brandon, Jordan, Skylar, and Kyle. Christine is preceded in death by her husband, Gerald, her parents, Winifred, and Betty Simmons. The family would like to express gratitude and well wishes. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Sue King Miller Townsend, age 86, of Abilene, Texas, formerly of Midland, Texas, passed away September 17, 2020. She was born in Courtney, Martin County, Texas, in 1934. She is survived by her daughter-in-law, Donna Miller of Abilene, Texas, granddaughter Shannon Miller Ganway and husband David of Abilene, great-grandson Carter Ganway of Abilene, Texas. Services will be held in Midland, Texas, with visitation at Ellis Funeral Home on Wednesday, September 23, 2020, from 5 to 7 p.m., and a graveside service only at Rest Haven Memorial Park on Thursday, September 24, 2020, at 1 p.m., officiated by Tim Baugh. Pallbearers are David Ganway, Jimmy Springer, Scott Miles, Nick Miles, Todd Wilson, and Jody Nix. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the American Cancer Society, Turning Point Ministries, or charity of your choice. Death notices. Michael Douglas Heath. Michael Douglas Heath, 56, of Odessa, passed on September 17, 2020. He was born January 23, 64. He is survived by his children, Derek Heath, Erica Galindo, Lauren Heath, and Lena Heath, two siblings and one grandchild. A graveside service will be held Monday, September 21, 2020, 2 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home, with burial immediately following at the American Heritage Cemetery. Richard Anthony Dominguez. Richard Anthony Dominguez, 45, of Pecos, passed from this life on September 11, 2020 in Pecos. He is survived by his father, Jose Dominguez, mother, Susanna Oliver, and one brother. There are no services scheduled at this time. Sharon Lee Horton, 72, of El Paso, passed away on September 15, 2020. She is survived by her daughters, Tracy Gonzalez and Tish Horton. Funeral service will be held Tuesday, September 22, 2020, with Clay Porter officiating. Burial immediately following. All arrangements are handled and will be held at American Heritage Cemetery and Funeral Home.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, September 22, 2020. Front page. Two teens recovering following wreck. Three other teens were killed during tragic accident. OA News at OAOA.com. Two Odessa teens were involved in a fatal collision that killed three other teenagers over the weekend, were in fair and good conditions on Monday, a medical center hospital official detailed. MCH Director of Public Relations Trevor Tankersley stated in an email that 19-year-old Benjamin Luna of Odessa was in fair condition, while 18-year-old Damarion Bro of Odessa was in good condition. Luna and Bro were both passengers who were reportedly involved in a two-vehicle collision that happened at 2:55 a.m. Saturday at the intersection of 52nd Street and Clover Avenue, an Odessa Police Department press release detailed. Investigations showing that 19-year-old Andrew Nading was driving a gray GMC Terrain East in the 1400 block of East 52nd Street, the Odessa Police Department press release stated. Luna was identified as the front passenger of the Terrain. Kenan Garms, 19, of Odessa, was reportedly driving a white Ford F-150 north in the 5100 block of Clover Avenue. The front passenger of the Ford F-150 was identified as Bro, while the back passenger was identified as 18-year-old Evan Hill of Odessa. Investigation showed the F-150 ran a stop sign, before colliding with the terrain, the press release stated. Garms and Hill were pronounced dead at the scene, while Nading was transported to a local hospital and later pronounced dead by medical personnel. According to a series of police reports, witnesses stated they saw Rowe climb out of the F-150 and walk into an alley. Another report stated police officer Calvin Taylor found Rowe in an alley near the intersection of 52nd Street and Locust Avenue, which was one block east of Clover Avenue. Officer Taylor detailed in his report that Rowe was bleeding from his nose and both legs and that he had a significant cut puncture wound on his right leg. A police report also details a video taken at 2:52 a.m. Saturday showed an unidentified black car run the stop sign as it traveled at a very high rate of speed going north on Clover Avenue and crossing East 52nd Street. Almost immediately after, the white Ford truck is seen chasing the black car and traveling north on Clover Avenue at a high rate of speed where it ran the stop sign. As the white Ford entered the intersection, the black SUV was reportedly traveling very fast, going east in the outside lane of East 52nd Street and crossing the intersection. The front end of the black SUV struck the driver's side of the white Ford truck, and both vehicles proceeded toward the northeast corner of the intersection. The truck is not seen rolling over due to a large tree obstructing any further view. Rowe stated to police that there were four people, including himself, in the truck, the report detailed. Rowe also stated he was in the back seat and did not recall a crash. However, he stated his friends stated the police were coming in to leave. Rowe reported not knowing he was in a crash and feared he would go to jail. Rowe and Luna were reportedly transported to a local hospital with life-threatening injuries. There were no reports of any other injuries. Next of kin for Garms, Nading, and Hill have been notified. GoFundMe pages have been created for Garms and Hill. OPD spokesperson Colonel Corporal Steve LeSueur said over the phone on Monday afternoon that the investigation is continuing. Garms GoFundMe, TINYURL.com/YYG2BBEH. Hill GoFundMe, TINYURL.com/YYV6MNOT. Council to vote on Odessa Public Facility Corporation by Michael Merlo, M-E-R-L-O at OAOA.com. Odessa City Council members will vote on multiple items during today's City Council meeting, including considering the creation of an Odessa Public Facility Corporation, PFC, for affordable housing. City Manager Michael Marrero told Council at a work session last Tuesday that the creation of a public facility corporation would be used as a vehicle for the creation of affordable housing in our community. He said that the creation of this corporation allows the city to partner with a developer to be able to construct workforce housing that is available to those who can pay market rates, but also those who earn less than 50% of the median income. The PFC will be a corporation made up of City Council, which would give council members the ability to work with developers to not only identify locations that would be ideal for the construction of homes, but to be involved in every aspect of that development, Marrero said. The city, under the PFC corporation, would not be required to put up any money. All the costs would be borne by the developer, and that is the developer's risk in this particular type of corporation. At-large Councilwoman Peggy Dean asked Marrero what the benefit to a developer would be regarding the PFC. Marrero said that the developer gets to obtain a tax exemption from the City of Odessa, and that is a property tax exemption for 99 years. He said further, explaining that the benefit to the city would be more housing, and the city gets to share revenue generated from the apartment complex, which in some cases is more money than the property taxes. Marrero said that at least 50% of the units have to be available to low-income residents. District 3 Councilmember Datra White asked about the quality of the housing, and Marrero said that the housing would be Type A property, which would be your higher-end-looking type property, and the City Council would be able to help along with the developer to identify properties that are suitable for the apartment complex. White said, I know there's always a concern when people hear that we are giving a tax exemption to a company, but this really is set up to benefit our citizens, correct? Yes, ma'am, and certainly the city as well, Marrero said, adding that many metropolitan cities in Texas have set up similar programs. The in-person meeting will be held at 6 p.m. at Odessa Regional Medical Center in the East Campus Auditorium at 515 North Adams. Council members will also consider the purchase of a command trailer for the Odessa Police Department for $289,036.77 and consider the request of Discover Odessa to roll over unused 2019-20 funds to be expended in fiscal year 2020-21. Consent agenda. Consider approval of the request by Jonathan Ramirez and Roberto Arenivas, owners, for a specific use permit to allow a beauty shop, one chair accessory use in a single family, 3, SF3, zoning district on Lot 5, Block 11, Ridgecrest West, 208 Monticello Drive. Ordinance, second and final approval. Consider appointment of judges and clerks for the general city election on November 3, 2020. Ordinance, second and final approval. Consider amending the Odessa City Code, Chapter 13, Utilities, Article 13.2, Water and Sewer Service, Division 3, Water Conservation and Drought Contingency Plan. Ordinance, second and final approval. Other council action. Request approval of bids from Vanco Insulation Incorporated for the emergency removal of 2 unsafe commercial structures for $133,495. Public hearing. Open a public hearing to consider approval of the request by Halliburton Energy Services, owner, Multitech agent, for original zoning of heavy industrial, HI, on lots 1 and 2, block 1, Halliburton subdivision, second filing, Odessa, Ector County, Texas, south of the intersection of Interstate 20 and Farm Road 1936. Ordinance, first approval. Resolution. Consider an economic development agreement between the Odessa Development Corporation and Gasket and Packings Incorporated. Review and approve the city's investment policy and the approved brokers, dealers, and financial institutions list. Appointment of boards. Citizen comments on non-agenda items. Fun in the sun. Above, catching up with the ball, Michaela Hansen hits the ball back across the court Monday morning at Optimist Park. Left, taking advantage of the cool Monday morning weather, cousins Jaden Honeyfield and Michaela Hansen play tennis together at Optimist Park. The two started playing tennis again Sunday to get some exercise and get out of the house. Photos by Ben Powell, Odessa American. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,649. Ector County negative, 21,663, out of 26,721 tested, with 409 pending. 93 deaths. Recovered, 3,951. Active, 605. Midland County, 3,551 confirmed cases with 81 deaths. Texas, 698,387 confirmed, with 5,622,498 tested. Total Texas deaths, 14,917. U.S. cases, 7,040,792 total confirmed, and 204,390 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Quick hits. Free COVID-19 testing. The City of Odessa, in partnership with the University of Texas Permian Basin, has scheduled the second round of free mobile COVID-19 testing events at the following times, dates, and locations. Wednesday, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., UTPB Park Soccer Field Parking, East Loop 338 and Highway 191. September 30th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Sherwood Park, East 49th Street and Cordova Street Parking Lot. October 14th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Floyd Gwynn Park Parking Lot, 1015 North County Road West. Events are for City of Odessa and Ector County residents. First come, first serve. Only 200 tests will be administered at each event. Participants must remain in their vehicle with the window up until a testing team member approaches you. Proof of residency will be required. Bring ID. No appointments or pre-registration required. Children as young as 3 years old are eligible for testing. For more information, call 557-6557 or visit www.odessa-tx.gov/COVID testing. Drive up and go flu shots. United Supermarkets, 2751 County Road West, is offering drive-up-and-go flu shots from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays through October 29th outside store location, flu shot tent. Flu immunizations are available for free with most insurance, no copayment unless required by your plan. Completing a consent form before you arrive will save you time. Wear a face covering during the immunization. Bring both your prescription and medical insurance cards. Wear clothing that provides easy access to your upper arm. For a consent form or more information, visit www.unitedsupermarkets.com/flu clinic. To reach a pharmacy team member, call 333-1591. From staff reports. Closing prices. Posted, $36. Futures, $39.31. Natural gas, $1.835. Benchmark U.S. fell $1.80 to $39.31 per barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. This is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020, OAOA.com. Local news roundup. Pink the Basin. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Pink the Basin's annual luncheon and most of the large gathering third-party fundraisers have been canceled. Those events made up 90% of last year's annual income. To continue offering life-saving diagnostic breast cancer services, PTB is requesting your support or participation in the following Pinking the Basin campaigns. Saturday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Third West Texas Breast Symposium, presented by the Breast Center of Midland Memorial Hospital. October, Run for the Basin, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. November 8th, 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., private shopping event. Raffle prizes every 15 minutes. To donate, get help, become a partner, or for more information, visit pinkthebasin.com. Therapeutic Mentoring. The Horse Center, Incorporated, 2306 East County Road 140, Midland, has scheduled H2 Horses and Heroes Equine Peer Therapeutic Mentoring, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. each Wednesday. There is no charge for veterans and first responders. Equine Peer Therapeutic Mentoring Group is a non-traditional therapeutic approach to mental wellness. Call 634-8726 or visit tinyurl.com/y837lvvr. Man charged with stabbing wife with wooden picket. OA News at OAOA.com. A 27-year-old man reportedly zip-tied his common-law wife's wrist, assaulted his common-law wife with a wooden picket, and was in possession of methamphetamine. David Muniz was charged with an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, family violence, a second-degree felony, and possession of a controlled substance, a third-degree felony. The reported assault happened at 4:57 p.m. Sunday in the area of North County Road West and Interstate 20, an Ector County Sheriff's Office affidavit stated. The victim was reportedly identified as 26-year-old Adeline Giselle Chavez. Chavez stated she was at D&D Auto on North County Road West with her common-law husband of 7 months, who was identified as Muniz. Chavez stated that she was attempting to leave the area with her sister when Muniz grabbed her and forced a zip tie around her wrist and tightening it to the point it started to cut off circulation to her hand, broke the skin, and began to turn her wrist blue, the affidavit stated. Chavez reportedly detailed to deputies that Muniz stabbed her with sharp wooden picket twice in the right knee, breaking the skin. Chavez stated Muniz grabbed a screwdriver and stuck it under the zip tie, pressing it against her skin, and broke the zip tie off. Chavez continued to detail that after the zip tie came off, she was unable to move her wrist. Chavez had several cuts from the zip tie, and it started to swell. Muniz was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. When he arrived to the jail, he was taken into a cell to be changed into his jail uniform. Muniz entered the cell and reached into his pants in the crotch area and produced a clear plastic baggie with a crystal rock substance believed to be methamphetamine. Jailers found more of the crystal rock substance in his right front pocket. Muniz has 2 bonds totaling $40,000 and was still in custody as of Monday afternoon. Jail records show. Man dies in hospital after involved in standoff with ECSO deputy. OA News at OAOA.com. A man died at a local hospital after he was involved in a standoff with an Ector County Sheriff's Office deputy as the law enforcement agency was attempting to serve an arrest warrant in West Odessa. The reported officer-involved shooting happened around 4 p.m. Friday in the 6,000 block of Sparta Avenue, an ECSO press release detailed. Deputies were reportedly attempting to serve an arrest warrant to Ricky Riney. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths detailed in a text message that the warrants were failure to appear for cruelty to livestock animals, a state jail felony, and deadly conduct, discharging a firearm, a third-degree felony. Ronnie's failure to appear for cruelty to livestock animals and deadly conduct stemmed from an incident that happened January 28th in the 6,000 block of Sparta Avenue when Ronnie allegedly shot his neighbor's horse in left rear hoof. On Friday afternoon, there was a brief standoff before ECSO Deputy Dustin Fowler shot Ronnie, the press release detailed. Ronnie was transported to Medical Center Hospital, where he was later pronounced dead. Fowler has served with ECSO as a patrol deputy since November 4, 2019, the press release stated. The incident is being investigated by the Texas Rangers.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.